testimony by defectors of his mother's adultery, and who killed his father, then turn him back on his own people. Kate said, "We understand that, Ted. What we don't understand is, after he got away, why did you let him complete his mission?" Ted replied, "We really had no idea what his specific mission was." "Excuse me," I said, "bullshit. You knew he'd be here at the Reagan Ranch, and you knew what he was going to do before he got here." "We'll believe what you want. We were under the impression that he was being sent here to kill Ronald Reagan. We didn't know he had the names of the pilots on that flight. That's classified information. In any case, it didn't matter what his mission was, because he was supposed to be taken into custody at Kennedy Airport. If that had happened, none of the other things would have happened." "Ted, Mom may have told you that when you play with fire, you get burned." Ted didn't want to be pushed into any gaping holes in his story, and if I left him alone, he'd dig a few more holes of his own. Ted said to us, "Well, the plan went astray, but it's not off the tracks yet. It's important that we apprehend Khalil and tell him what we know about his mother and father, then let him loose in Libya. By the way, it was a family friend who killed Karim Khalil in Paris. A man named Habib Nadir, a fellow army captain and friend of Captain Khalil. Nadir killed his friend on direct orders from Muammar Gaddafi." This was a tough crowd in a tough neighborhood. Ted, who was not stupid, said, "Of course, it's possible that Assad Khalil will get out of the country and back to Libya before we have an opportunity to speak to him. So what I was wondering is if either of you thought to pass on what you knew about Gaddafi's treachery toward the Khalil family." I replied, "Let me think. We talked about his grudges against America, about him wanting to kill me. What else?" "I understand from your colleagues at the Wiggins house that you mentioned these subjects briefly at the end of your conversation with Khalil." "Right. That was after I called him a camel fucker." "No wonder he wants to kill you." Ted laughed, then asked me, "And did you expand on this in your subsequent conversation with Khalil? You seem to know a lot about what goes on in the FBI. We're on the same team, John." "I hope not." "Oh, don't be holier than thou. The halo doesn't look good on you." I let that one go and said to Kate, "Okay, ready to roll?" I said to Ted, "Gotta go, Ted. See you at the Senate inquest." "Just a moment. Please answer my question. Did you speak to Assad Khalil about Gaddafi's treachery? What do you think?" "I'll guess that you did, partly because you seemed keen about that angle during our meetings in New York and Washington, partly because you're very bright and you know how to piss off people." He smiled. I smiled too. Ted was really an okay guy, just a little devious. I said, "Yeah, I got him all worked up about that. You should have heard that conversation when I told him his mother was a whore and his father was a cuckold. Not to mention Gaddafi having Pop whacked." Jeez, he was pissed. He said he was going to cut my tongue out and slit my throat. I mean, I didn't fuck his mother or kill his father. Why was he so pissed off at me? Ted seemed to be enjoying my levity, and he was also very happy to learn that I had done his job for him. Ted asked me, "And it was your impression that he believed you?" "How the hell do I know? He wanted to kill me. He didn't say anything about Uncle Muammar." Ted pondered a moment, then said, "For the Arabs, this is a matter of personal honor, family honor, which they call ird. Almost any family dishonor has to be redeemed in blood." "That probably works better than family court." Ted looked at me and said, "I think Khalil will kill Gaddafi, and if he learns the truth about Habib Nadir, he will kill him also, and maybe others in Libya. Then our plan, which you seem to find so distasteful, will be vindicated." Kate, who has a better moral compass than I, said, "There's no justification to goad people into murdering anyone. We don't have to act like monsters to fight monsters." She added, "This is wrong." Ted, wisely, did not go into a big justification of his pet plan to clip Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. He said to Kate, "Believe me, we struggled with this question and put it before the Ethics Committee." I almost laughed. "Are you on that committee? And by the way, What are the ethics of you joining up with the ATTF in order to advance your own game plan? And how the hell did I wind up working with you? I requested it. I really admire your talents and your perseverance. In fact, you nearly stopped Khalil from escaping at the airport. I told you, if you want to work for us, there's a job available. You too, Kate. I replied, we'll talk it over with our spiritual advisors. Okay, gotta go, Ted. Great meeting. Just one or two more things. Okay, shoot. Bad choice of words. I wanted to tell you I enjoyed that joke. The one you told at the meeting about the Attorney General? Edward passed that on to me. There's a lot of truth in jokes. The FBI would call a big press conference, as they're doing this afternoon in Washington. My company doesn't like press conferences. Hey, I'm with you. And the CIA would make the rabbit a double agent. He smiled. That was funny. Also, very prescient in this case. I hear you. And don't forget what the cops would do, Ted. They'd beat the shit out of that bear until he confessed to being a rabbit. Right? I'm sure they would. But that doesn't make the bear a rabbit. It's only important that the bear says he's a rabbit. And while we're at it, double agents only work for themselves. Are we through here? Almost. I just want to remind you both that this conversation never took place. He looked at Kate and said, it's very important that Assad Khalil go back to Libya. Kate replied, no, it's not. It's important that he stand trial for murder in the U.S. Ted said to me, I think you understand. Am I going to argue with a guy who's holding a high-powered rifle? Ted informed me, I'm not threatening either of you. Don't be melodramatic. Sorry, it's this X-Files thing. TV is rotting my brain. It used to be Mission Impossible. Okay, that's it. See ya. I really wouldn't walk back to the ranch house now. Khalil is still out there, and you two are sitting ducks. Ted, if it's a choice between staying here with you or dodging sniper bullets, guess what? Don't say I didn't warn you. I didn't reply, but turned and walked away, as did Kate. Ted called out, oh, congratulations on your engagement. Invite me to the wedding. My back was still to him, and I waved. Funny thing, I wouldn't mind inviting him to the wedding. The man was a monumental prick, but when all was said and done, he was our prick. He really wanted to do what was best for the country. It's scary. But I understood, which was also scary. We kept walking down this slope away from the Vortac station. I didn't know if I was going to get a bullet in the back from Ted or a bullet in the front from Khalil in the tree line at the foot of the slope. We kept walking, and I could tell that Kate was tense. I said, it's okay. Just whistle. My mouth is dry. Hum. I feel sick to my stomach. Uh-oh. Like morning, John. Stop with the jokes. This is just sickening. Do you understand what he's done? They play a rough and dangerous game, Kate. Judge not, lest you be judged. People were murdered. I don't want to talk about it now, okay? She shook her head. We found a riding path which cut through an expanse of red rocks and thick bush. I was hoping to run into a motorized patrol or a stationary post, but there's never a Secret Service agent around when you need one. The sky was much lighter now, and a soft breeze from the sea started to move the ground fog away. Not good. We walked in the direction of where we thought the ranch house and Secret Service building were, but the trail seemed to twist and turn a lot, and I wasn't sure where the hell we were. Kate said, I think we're lost. My feet hurt. I'm tired and thirsty. Let's sit a while. We sat on a flat rock and rested. There was strange vegetation here, like probably sagebrush, tumbleweed, and all that cowboy stuff. The brush was thick but not very tall, and not tall enough to provide good concealment when we walked. It occurred to me that we might be better off staying put. I said to Kate, assuming Khalil is out there, then he's probably within 200 yards of the ranch house. So maybe we don't want to get too close to the house or the Secret Service place. Good thought. We'll stay here so Khalil can kill us without disturbing anyone else. I'm just trying to outthink this guy. Well, think about this. Maybe he's not going to kill us. Maybe he's going to put a few rounds through our legs, then walk over to us and cut your tongue out, then slit your throat. I see you've given this some thought. Thank you for sharing that. Sorry. She yawned. Anyway, we have our pistols, and I won't let him take you alive. She laughed, but it was sort of an emotionally and physically exhausted kind of laugh. Get some rest. About 10 minutes later, I heard this vaguely familiar sound and recognized it as helicopter blades beating the air. I stood on the rock on which I'd been sitting and hopped onto a nearby 4-foot-high boulder and faced the sound. I said, "The cavalry has arrived. Air cavalry." "Wow. Look at that." "What?" She stood, but I put my hand on her shoulder and pressed her down. "Just sit. I'll tell you what's going on." "I can see for myself." She stood on the rock on which she'd been sitting, grabbed my arm, and pulled herself up beside me on the boulder. We both looked toward the helicopters. There were 6 Hueys circling a few hundred yards away, and I guessed they were circling over the ranch house. So we were close, and we knew what direction to walk. I now noticed a huge twin-engine Chinook helicopter coming over the horizon, and slung under the Chinook was an automobile, a big black Lincoln. Kate said, "That must be an armored vehicle." "Stagecoach," I reminded her. 6 Hollies with Hercules personnel flying cover over Brimstone while Rawhide and Rainbow get into the stagecoach. Tracker and Tracer on the ground, Donner, Blitzen, and Rudolph on the way. She let out a sigh of relief, or maybe exasperation. We watched for a few minutes as the operation unfolded, and though we couldn't see what was happening on the ground, it was obvious that Rawhide and Rainbow were now headed down Pennsylvania Avenue in an armored car with escort vehicles and the choppers overhead. Mission accomplished. Asad Khalil, if he was anywhere around, could see this too, of course, and if he was still wearing his phony mustache, he was right now twirling the ends and saying, "Curses! Foiled again!" So, all's well that ends well, right? Not quite. I had the thought that Asad Khalil, having missed the big one, would now settle for the little one. But before I did anything about that thought, like get off that boulder and into the bushes to wait for help, Asad Khalil switched targets. Chapter 56. What happened next happened like it was in slow motion, between the beats of a heart. I told Kate to jump off the boulder. I jumped, but she was a half second behind me. I never heard the crack of the silenced rifle, but I knew the shot came from the nearby tree line because I could hear the bullet buzzing like a bee over my head, where I had stood on the boulder a half second before. Kate seemed to stumble on the boulder and let out a soft cry of pain as though she'd twisted her ankle. In an instant, I realized I'd gotten the sequence of events wrong. She'd cried out in pain first, then stumbled. Again, as if it was slow motion, I saw her fall off the side of the boulder near the trail. I dove on top of her, wrapped my arms around her, and rolled away from the trail, down a shallow slope and into some thin bushes as another bullet slammed into a rock near our heads, sending splinters of stone and steel into my neck. I rolled again, Kate still in my arms, but we were stopped by a thicket of brush. I held her tightly and said, "Don't move." We were side by side, my back to the direction of the fire, and I craned my head over my shoulder to see what Khalil could see from the tree line, which was less than 100 yards away. There were some bushes and low rocks between us and Khalil's line of fire, but depending on where he was in those trees, he might still have a clear shot. I was aware that my suit, dark though it was, did not blend well with the surroundings, and neither did Kate's bright red jacket. But since there was no more firing, I was fairly certain that Khalil had lost us for the time being. Either that, or he was savoring the moment until he fired again. I turned and looked into Kate's eyes. They were squinting with pain, and she was starting to writhe in my arms. I said, "Don't move. Kate, talk to me." She was breathing hard now, and I couldn't tell where or how badly she'd been hit, but I could feel warm blood now, seeping through my shirt and onto my cold skin. "Damn it!" Kate, talk to me. Talk to me. Oh, I'm hit. Okay, take it easy. Stay still. Let me check it out. I moved my right arm between us and felt around under her blouse, my fingers probing for the entry wound, which I couldn't find, though there was blood all over. Oh, God. I tilted my head back and looked at her face. There was no blood coming from her mouth or nose, which was hopeful, and her eyes looked clear. Oh, John, damn it. It hurts. Finally, I found the entry wound, a hole just below the bottom of her left rib cage. I quickly ran my hand around the back and found the exit wound just above her buttocks. It seemed to be no more than a deep flesh wound, and there was no spurting blood, but I worried about internal bleeding. I said to her, as you're supposed to do with injured people, Kate, it's okay. You'll be fine. Are you sure? Yes. She took a deep breath and moved her own hand to the wound, exploring the entry and exit wounds. I got a handkerchief out of my pocket and pushed it in her hand. Hold it there. We lay motionless again, side by side, and waited. That bullet had been meant for me, of course. But fate, ballistics, trajectories, and timing are what makes the difference between a wound that you can show off and a wound that the Undertaker has to fill with putty. I said again, you're okay. It's just a little scratch. Kate put her mouth to my ear, and I could feel her breath on my skin. She said, John. Yes. You're a fucking idiot. Huh? But I love you anyway. Now let's get the hell out of here. No, just stay still. He can't see us, and he can't hit what he can't see. I spoke too soon because all of a sudden dirt and rocks started erupting around us, and branches snapped over our heads. I knew Khalil had a general idea of where we were, and he was firing the rest of the 14-round magazine at our suspected location. Jesus H. I thought the firing was never going to stop. It's worse when they use a silencer, and all you can hear are the rounds hitting without hearing the crack of the rifle. On what must have been his last round, I felt a sharp pain on my hip, and my hand flew back to where I'd been hit. I'd caught a grazing wound across my pelvis, and I could sense that it was deep enough to have chipped the pelvic bone. Damn it! Johnny, you all right? Yeah. We have to get out of here. Okay, I'll count to three and we'll run in a crouch through these bushes, but not for more than 3 seconds. Then we dive and roll, okay? Okay. One, two, hold on. Why don't we go back to that boulder we were standing on? I turned my head and looked back at the boulder. It was less than 4 feet high and not even that wide. The rocks around it, where we'd been sitting, were no more than large stones. But if we could crouch behind the boulder, we'd be safe from direct fire coming from the tree line. I said, okay, but it's a little tight behind there. Let's go before he fires again. One, two, three. We sprang up into a crouch and ran toward the boulder, which was also toward Khalil. About halfway there, I heard that familiar buzzing over my head, but Khalil had to fire above the boulder we were running for, and he wasn't sitting high enough in the tree to get a steep enough angle to pick us off. Kate and I hit the rock, spun around, and sat side by side very close together, our knees up to our chests. She pressed the bloody handkerchief to her left side. We sat there a second and caught our breath. I didn't hear any buzzing overhead, and I wondered if the bastard had the balls to leave the cover of the trees and was coming toward us. I pulled my Glock, took a deep breath, poked my head around the rock, and scanned the open space very quickly before pulling my head back in, just in time to avoid having it blown off by a well-placed shot that chipped the side of the boulder. This guy knows how to shoot. What the fuck are you doing? Just sit here. Where did you learn to swear like that? I have never sworn so much in my life till I met you. Really? Sit and shut up. Okay. So we sat there, oozing blood, but not enough to attract sharks or whatever they had around there. Asad Khalil was strangely quiet, and I was getting nervous about what he was up to. I mean, the asshole could be 20 feet away, slithering through the bush. I said, I'm going to fire a few shots in the air to attract attention and to keep Khalil away. No, if you attract some Secret Service people here, Khalil will pick them off. I don't want that on my conscience. We're not in any danger. Just sit. I wasn't sure that we weren't in any danger, but the rest of it made sense. So John Corey, man of action, just sat. After a minute, I said, maybe I can attract Ted's attention, then he and Khalil can have a shooting contest. Sit and be quiet. Listen for any sounds in the bush. Good idea. Kate shimmied out of her red jacket, which was nearly the same color as the blood that soaked it. She tied the sleeves around her waist, fashioning a pressure tourniquet over the wounds. Kate reached into one of her jacket pockets and said, I'll call the Seascape Motel and advise them of our situation so they can alert the Secret Service here and... She kept searching through her pockets, then said, I can't find my cell phone. Uh-oh. We both felt around on the ground. Kate reached too far to her left side, and the ground exploded inches from her hand. She pulled her hand in like she'd touched the hot stove and stared at the back of it. She said, my God, I felt that round brush my knuckles. But I'm not actually hit. I felt the heat or something. The man can shoot. Meanwhile, where's the cell phone? She rummaged around her jacket and pants pockets again and announced, it must have fallen out of my pocket when we were rolling. Damn it. We both stared out at the brush-covered slope in front of us, but there was no way to know where the phone was, and for sure, neither of us was going to go searching for it. So we sat there, listening for the sound of someone moving toward us. In a way, I hoped the bastard was coming for us, because I knew he'd have to come around the boulder or over the top of it, and we'd hear him. I wanted at least one shot at him. But if he circled wide, we wouldn't see him or hear him, and he had the rifle with the scope. I suddenly felt less safe on this side of the boulder, knowing that Khalil could be circling around into the bushes we'd just come from. She said, sorry about the phone. Not your fault. I guess I should get a cell phone. Not a bad idea. I'll buy one for you. A helicopter flew by about a quarter mile away, but he didn't see us or sense us, or Khalil, with whatever sensing device he had. Neither did Khalil fire at him, which would have been an easy shot. This led me to believe that Asad Khalil was gone, or Mr. Khalil was holding his fire because he really wanted me. Now there's an upsetting thought. Anyway, I'd had enough of this bullshit. I got out of my jacket, and before Kate could stop me, I stood quickly and waved the jacket to my side, like a matador messing around with a bull's horns. Unlike a matador, however, I got rid of the jacket real quick as I ducked behind the boulder, just in time to hear the little buzz that ventilated the jacket and snapped some branches off to our side. Before Kate could yell at me, I said, I think he's still in the tree line. And how do you know that? The shot came from that direction. I could tell by the buzzing and the impact, and there was a half-second delay like he was still 100 yards away. Are you making this up? Sort of. Well, back to the game of nerves. Just when I thought Khalil was winning, Mr. Steely Assassin became frustrated and started shooting again. The prick was amusing himself by firing chip shots across the top of the boulder, and shards of stone were spraying into the air and falling down on us. He fired a full magazine, then reloaded and began firing on either side of the boulder, so that the strike of the rounds was just inches from our tucked-up legs. I watched, fascinated, as the pebbly earth exploded into little craters. I said to Kate, this guy's an asshole. She didn't reply, mesmerized by the flying dirt around us. Khalil then shifted his aim closer to the sides of the boulder, and the guy was good, just skimming the sides, inches from our shoulders. The boulder was getting a little smaller. I said to Kate, where did he learn to shoot like that? She replied, if I had a rifle, I'd show him how to shoot. She added, if I'd had a vest, I wouldn't be bleeding. Remember that for next time. I took her hand and squeezed it. How you doing? Okay. It's hurting like hell now. Hang in there. He'll get tired of playing with his gun. She asked me, how are you? I have a new wound to show the girls. How'd you like another one? I squeezed her hand again and said stupidly, his and her wounds. That's not even funny. This fucking thing is throbbing. I untied her jacket, put my hand around her back, and gently felt the exit wound. She let out a cry of pain. I said, it's starting to clot. Try not to move and break the clot. Keep holding the entry wound with a handkerchief. I know. God, this hurts. I know. Been there, done that. I retied the jacket around her waist. Khalil had another idea and started firing at the smaller rocks around us, causing ricochets like a pool player trying to make a shot from behind the eight ball. The rocks were sandstone and most of them shattered, but now and then Khalil got his ricochet, and one of the rounds actually struck the boulder above my head. I said to Kate, "Tuck your head and face between your legs." I added, "Persistent little bastard, isn't he?" She tucked her head between her knees and said, "He really doesn't like you, John. You've inspired him to new levels of creativity." I do that to people. All of a sudden, I felt a sharp pain in my right thigh, and I realized he'd gotten me with a ricochet. Damn! What's the matter? I felt where the hot round had hit me and discovered a tear in my pants and a rip in my flesh. I felt around the ground near my thigh and found a still warm, distorted bullet which I held up. 7.62mm steel-jacketed military round, probably from an M14 modified as a sniper rifle with interchangeable night-and-day scopes, plus silencer and flash suppressor. Just like the one Jean had. Who gives a shit? Just making conversation. I added, also just like the one Ted has. We let that sit a while, putting some silly thoughts out of our minds. I added, of course, the M14 is a fairly common army surplus rifle, and I didn't mean to suggest anything by mentioning that Ted happened to have one. Finally, Kate said, he could have killed us at the Vortac station. To continue the paranoid moment, I pointed out, he wouldn't whack us so close to where Jean dropped us off to meet him. She didn't reply. Of course, I didn't really think it was Ted who was trying to kill us. Ted wouldn't do that. Ted wanted to come to our wedding, right? But you never know. I put the spent bullet in my pocket. We sat there for a quiet 5 minutes, and I figured whoever he was gone. But I had no intention of finding out for sure. I could hear helicopters circling in the distance and hoped that eventually one of them would see us. Despite the pain in my pelvis, I was starting to drift off. I was totally exhausted and also dehydrated, so I thought I was getting delirious when I heard a phone ring. I opened my eyes. What the hell? Kate and I stared down the slope to where the phone was ringing. I still couldn't see it, but I had a general idea of where it was. I could tell now that it wasn't more than 20 feet away. It was actually directly in front of us, and if I ran out to it, I'd be blocked from Khalil's line of sight by the boulder. Maybe. Before I could decide if I wanted to risk it, the phone stopped ringing. I said, if we can get that phone, we can call for help. Kate replied, if we go out to get that phone, we won't need any help. We'll be dead. Right. We kept staring at the spot where the phone had been ringing. It began ringing again. It's a fact that a sniper can't continually stare through a telescopic lens without getting eye and arm fatigue, so he has to take short breaks. Maybe Khalil was on a break. In fact, maybe Khalil was calling us. He can't shoot and talk at the same time, right? Before I thought about it too much longer, I sprang forward in a crouch, covered the 20 feet in 2 seconds, located the ringing phone, scooped it up, spun around, and charged back toward the boulder, keeping the boulder between me and Khalil's line of fire. Before I reached the boulder, I pitched the ringing phone to Kate, who caught it. I hit the boulder, spun, and fell into a sitting position, wondering why I was still alive. I took a few deep breaths. Kate had the phone to her ear and was listening. She said into the phone, "Fuck you." She listened again and said, "Don't tell me how a woman should talk. Fuck you." I had the feeling that wasn't Jack Koenig. She put the phone to her chest and said to me, "Are you very brave or very stupid? How could you do that without consulting me? Would you rather be dead than married? Is that it?" "Excuse me, who's on the phone?" Kate handed the phone to me. "Khalil wants to say goodbye." We looked at each other, embarrassed, I think, by our brief suspicions that it was Ted Nash, our compatriot, who'd been trying to kill us. I had to get out of this business. I said to her, "You ought to get your number changed." I put the phone to my ear and said, "Corey." Asad Khalil said to me, "You're a very lucky man. God is looking after me." He must be. I don't often miss. "We all have off days, Asad. Go home and practice." "I admire your courage and your good humor in the face of death." "Thanks so much. Hey, why don't you get out of that tree, put down your rifle, and come across that field with your hands up? I'll see that you get treated fairly by the authorities. He laughed and said, I am not in the tree. I am on my way home. I just wanted to say goodbye and to remind you that I will be back. Looking forward to a rematch. Fuck you. A religious man shouldn't talk like that. Fuck you. No, fuck you, Assad, and fuck the camel you rode up on. I will kill you and kill that whore you are with if it takes me all of my life. I'd obviously gotten him angry again, so to direct his anger toward more constructive goals, I reminded him, don't forget to first get things straightened out with Uncle Momar. Also, it was a guy named Habib Nadir who killed your father in Paris on orders of Momar. You know this guy? There was no reply, and neither did I expect one. The phone went dead, and I handed it back to Kate. He and Ted would like one another. So we sat there, not quite trusting Assad to be hot-footing it through the mountains, especially after that last conversation. Maybe I needed to take a Dale Carnegie course. Kate called the Seascape Motel and got Kim Ree on the phone. She explained our situation and present position sitting behind a boulder, and Kim said she'd get some Secret Service people to us. Kate added, tell them to be careful. I'm not sure if Khalil is actually gone. She signed off and said to me, you think he's gone? I think so. The lion knows when to run and when to attack. Right? To lighten the moment, I asked her, what's the difference between an Arab terrorist and a woman with PMS? Tell me. You can reason with an Arab terrorist. That's not funny. Okay, then what's the definition of a moderate Arab? What? A guy who ran out of ammunition. That's funny. The sun got warm and burned off the remaining fog. We held hands, waiting for a chopper to notice us, or a vehicle or foot patrol to come by. Kate said, as if to herself, this was a taste of things to come. Indeed it was. And Assad Khalil or the next guy like him would be back with some new grudge, and we'd send a cruise missile into somebody's house in retaliation, and round it goes. I said to Kate, you want to get out of this business? No. Do you? Only if you do. I like it, she said. Whatever you like, I like. I like California. I like New York. How about Minnesota? Is that a city or a state? Eventually, a helicopter spotted us, and after determining that we weren't crazed Arab terrorists, it landed, and we were carried on board. Chapter 57, the last chapter. They flew us to a helipad at the Santa Barbara County Hospital, and we were given adjoining rooms with not much of a view. A lot of our new friends from the Ventura FBI office stopped by to say hello. Cindy, Chuck, Kim, Tom, Scott, Edie, Roger, and Juan. Everyone told us how well we looked. I figure if I keep getting shot once a year, I'll look terrific by the time I'm 50. My phone rang constantly, as you can imagine. Jack Koenig, Captain Stein, my ex-partner Dom Finelli, my ex-wife Robin, family, friends, past and present colleagues, and on and on. Everyone seemed very concerned about my condition, of course, and always asked first how I was doing and waited patiently while I said I was fine before they got into the important stuff about what happened. Hospital patients get away with a lot of crap, as I recalled from my last stay. Therefore, depending on who was calling, I had five standard lines. I'm on painkillers and can't concentrate. It's time for my sponge bath. This line is not secure. I have a thermometer up my ass. My mental health worker doesn't want me to dwell on the incident. Obviously, you have to use the appropriate line for different people. Telling Jack Koenig, for instance, that I had a thermometer up my ass. Well, point made. On day two, Beth Penrose called. I didn't think any of the standard lines were appropriate for that conversation, so we had the talk. End of story. She wished me well, and she meant it. I wished her well, and I meant it. A few people from the Los Angeles office also stopped in to see how Kate was doing, and a few of them even looked in on me, including Douglas Pindick, who turned off my intravenous. Just kidding. Another visitor was Gene Barlett of the Secret Service. He invited Kate and me back to the Reagan Ranch for a tour when we were up to it. He said, I'll show you the place where you were shot. You can have chips from the rock. Take a few photographs. I assured him I had no interest in memorializing the event, but Kate accepted his invitation. Anyway, I learned from various and sundry people that Asad Khalil seemed to have disappeared, which did not surprise me. There were two possibilities regarding Mr. Khalil's disappearance. One, he'd made it back to Tripoli. Two, the CIA had him and were turning him around, trying to convince the lion that certain Libyans tasted better than Americans. On that subject, I still didn't know if Ted and company actually let Asad Khalil go through with his mission of killing those pilots in order to make Khalil feel more fulfilled, and therefore happy and more receptive to the idea of whacking Uncle Muammar and friends. Also, I really wondered where the Libyans had gotten the names of those pilots. I mean, that's really an X-Files conspiracy theory, and it was so far out I didn't waste too much time on it or lose too much sleep over it. Still, it bothered me. As for Ted, I wondered why he hadn't come to pay us a visit, but I figured he had his hands full juggling lies, juking and jiving through the halls of Langley. On day three of our hospital stay, four gentlemen arrived from Washington, representatives, they said, of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, though one of the guys smelled like CIA. Kate and I were well enough to meet them in a private visitor's room. They took statements from us, of course, because that's what they do. They love to take statements, but rarely make any statements of their own. They did say, however, that Asad Khalil was still not in FBI custody, which may have been technically true. I mentioned to these gentlemen that Mr. Khalil swore to kill Kate and me if it took the rest of his life. They told Kate and me not to be overly concerned, don't talk to strangers, and be home before the streetlights came on, or something like that. We made a tentative appointment to meet in Washington when we felt up to it. Happily, no one mentioned a press conference. Related to that subject, we were reminded that we'd signed various oaths, pledges, and so forth, limiting our rights to make public statements, and swearing to safeguard all information that related to national security. In other words, don't speak to the press or we'll chew your asses up so bad those bullet wounds on your butts will look like little zits by comparison. This wasn't exactly a threat because the government does not threaten its citizens, but it was a fair warning. I reminded my colleagues that Kate and I were heroes, but no one seemed to know anything about that. I then announced to the four gentlemen that it was time for my enema, and they left. On the subject of the press again, the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan was reported in all the news media, but it was played down, and the official statement from Washington was, "The former president's life was never in danger." No mention was made of Asad Khalil. The lone individual involved was unknown, and no one seemed to get the connection between the dead pilots and the assassination attempt. That would change, of course, but as Alan Parker would say, a third today, a third tomorrow, and the rest when reporters start squeezing our nuts. On day four of our stay in Santa Barbara County Hospital, Mr. Edward Harris, CIA colleague of Ted Nash, showed up all by himself, and we received him in the private visitor's room. He too reminded us not to speak to the press and suggested that we'd had a bad shock, loss of blood and all that, and therefore our memories weren't to be trusted. Kate and I had previously discussed this, and we assured Mr. Harris that we couldn't even remember what we had for lunch. I also said to him, I don't even know why I'm in the hospital. The last thing I remember is driving to Kennedy Airport to pick up a defector. Edward looked a bit skeptical, and he said, don't overdo it. I informed Mr. Harris, I won that $20 bet from you, and 10 from Ted. He gave me a sort of funny look which seemed inappropriate. I think it had to do with the mention of Ted's name. I should say at this point that nearly everyone who visited us acted as though they had some information that we didn't have, but that we could have it if we asked. So I asked Edward, where's Ted? Edward let a few seconds pass, then informed us, Ted Nash is dead. I wasn't totally surprised, but I was shocked nonetheless. Kate was stunned, too, and asked, how? Edward replied, he was discovered after you were found on the Reagan Ranch. He had a bullet wound through his forehead and died instantly. Edward added, we recovered the bullet and ballistics prove conclusively that it was from the same rifle that Asad Khalil used to fire at you. Kate and I sat there, not knowing what to say. I did feel badly, but if Ted were in the room, I'd tell him the obvious. When you play with fire, you get burned. When you play with lions, you get eaten. Kate and I passed on our condolences, me wondering why Ted's death had not yet made the news. Edward suggested, as Ted had done, that we might be happy working for the Central Intelligence Agency. I didn't think this kind of happiness was at all possible, but when you're dealing with slick, you have to be slicker. I said to Edward, "We can talk." Ted would have liked that. Again, I detected a bit of skepticism from Edward, but he said, "The pay is better. You can pick any foreign duty station and be guaranteed a 5-year posting. Together. Paris, London, Rome, your pick." This sounded a little like a bribe, which is a whole lot better than a threat. Point was, we knew too much, and they knew we knew too much. I told Edward, "I've always wanted to live in Lithuania. Kate and I will talk it over." Edward wasn't used to being jerked around, and he got real cool and left. Kate reminded me, "You shouldn't smartass those people. I don't often get the opportunity." She sat silently a moment and said, "Poor Ted." I wondered if he was really dead, so I couldn't work through the grieving process with any enthusiasm. I said to Kate, "Invite him to the wedding anyway. You never know." By day 5 in the hospital, I figured if I stayed there any longer, I'd never recover physically or mentally, so I checked myself out, which made my government health insurance rep happy. In fact, I could have left after day 2, considering my fairly minor hip and thigh wounds, but the feds had wanted me to stay, and so did Kate, whose injury needed more time to heal. I said to Kate, "Ventura Inn Beach Resort. See you there." And off I went, with a bottle of antibiotics and some really neat painkillers. Someone had actually sent my clothes out for cleaning, and the suit had come back cleaned and pressed, with the 2 bullet holes sort of mended or crocheted or something. The bloodstains were still faintly visible on the suit and my old blue shirt and tie, though my shorts and socks were nice and fresh. A hospital van took me to Ventura. I felt like a vagrant, checking into the Ventura Inn without luggage, not to mention stained clothes and spaced out on painkillers. But Mr. American Express soon put things right, and I got California duds, swam in the ocean, watched X-Files reruns, and spoke to Kate 2 a day on the phone. Kate joined me a few days later, and we took some medical leave at the Ventura Inn, and I worked on my tan and learned to eat avocados. Anyway, Kate had this teensy bikini, and she soon realized that scars don't tan. Guys think scars are badges of honor. Women don't. But I kissed the boo-boo every night, and she became less self-conscious. In fact, she started showing off the entry and exit wounds to some cabana boys who thought a bullet wound was really cool. Kate, between cabana boys and war stories, tried to teach me how to surf, but I think you have to have capped teeth and bleached hair to do it right. So we got to know each other better in the 2 weeks trial honeymoon that we spent in Ventura, and by silent mutual consent we realized we were made for one another. For instance, Kate assured me she loved watching football games on TV, liked sleeping with the window open in the winter, preferred Irish pubs instead of fancy restaurants, hated expensive clothes and jewelry, and would never change her hairstyle. I believed every word, of course. I promised to stay the same. That was easy. All good things must come to an end, and in mid-May we returned to New York and our jobs at 26 Federal Plaza. There was a little office party for us, as is the custom, and dopey speeches were made, toasts were proposed to our dedication to the job, to our full recovery, and of course, to our engagement and long, happy lives together. Everyone loves a love story. It was the longest night of my life. To make the evening more fun, Jack pulled me aside and said, "I used your $30 and also Ted and Edward's bets towards the caterer's bill. I knew you wouldn't mind." Right. And Ted would have wanted it that way. All things considered, I'd rather be back in Homicide North, but that wasn't going to happen. Captain Stein and Jack Koenig assured me that I had a brilliant future ahead of me on the anti-terrorist task force, despite a stack of formal complaints lodged against me by various individuals and organizations. Upon our return to duty, Kate announced that she was rethinking things. Not about the marriage, but about the engagement ring. She put me to work on something called the invitation list. Also, I found Minnesota on a map. It's a whole state. I faxed copies of the map to my buds on the NYPD to show them. A few days after our return, we made the mandatory trip to the J. Edgar Hoover building and spent 3 days with these nice people from counterterrorism, who listened to our whole story, then repeated it to us in a slightly different form. We all got our stories straight, and Kate and I signed affidavits, statements, transcripts, and stuff until everyone was happy. I suppose we caved in a little, but we got a major promise from them that might put things right someday. On the fourth day of our Washington trip, we were taken to CIA headquarters at Langley, Virginia, where we met Edward Harris and others. It wasn't a long visit, and we were in the company of four FBI people who did most of the talking for us. Wish these people could just learn to get along. The only interesting thing about this Langley visit was our meeting with an extraordinary man. He was an ex-KGB guy, and his name was Boris, the same Boris that Ted had mentioned to us at the Vortac. There seemed to be no purpose to the meeting other than the fact that Boris wanted to meet us. But in the hour that we spoke, I got the feeling that this guy had seen and done more in his life than all of us in that room combined. Boris was a big dude, chain-smoked Marlboros, and was overly nice to my fiancée. He talked a little about his KGB days, then gave us a few tidbits about his second career with Libyan intelligence. He mentioned that he'd given Khalil a few tips about his trip to America. Boris was curious about how we got onto Assad Khalil and all that. I'm not in the habit of spilling a lot of information to foreign intelligence officers, but the guy played one for one with us, and if Kate or I answered his question, he'd answer ours. I could have spoken to this guy for days, but we had other people in the room, and once in a while they'd tell one of us not to reply or to change the subject. What happened to freedom of speech? Anyway, we all had a little nip of vodka together and inhaled secondhand smoke. One of the CIA boys announced that it was time to leave, and we all stood. I said to Boris, "We should meet again." He shrugged and made a motion toward his CIA friends. We shook hands, and Boris said to Kate and me, "That man is a perfect killing machine, and what he doesn't kill today, he will kill tomorrow." "He's just a man," I replied. "Sometimes I wonder." He added, "In any case, I congratulate you both on your survival. Don't waste any of your days." I was sure this was just another Russian expression and had nothing to do with the subject of Assad Khalil, right? Kate and I returned to New York and neither of us mentioned Boris again. But I'd really like to have a whole bottle of vodka with that guy someday. Maybe I'd issue him a subpoena. Maybe that wasn't a good idea. The weeks passed and still no word from Assad Khalil and no happy news out of Libya concerning Mr. Gaddafi's sudden demise. Kate never got her cell phone number changed, and I still have the same direct dial at 26 Federal Plaza, and we're waiting for a call from Mr. Khalil. Better than that, Stein and Koenig, as part of our deal with the folks in Washington, instructed us to form a special team consisting of me, Kate, Gabe, George Foster, and a few other people whose sole mission is to find and apprehend Mr. Assad Khalil. I also put in a request to the NYPD to transfer my old partner, Dom Finelli, to the ATTF. He's fighting it, but I'm an important person now, and I'll have Dom in my clutches soon. I mean, he's responsible for me being in the ATTF, and what good screwing deserves another. It'll be like old times. There will be no CIA people on this new team, which improves our odds a lot. This special team is probably the only thing that kept me on this screwed-up job. I mean, I take that guy's threat seriously, and it's a very simple matter of kill or be killed. None of us on the team intend to take Assad Khalil alive, and Assad Khalil himself does not intend to be taken alive, so it works out well for everyone. I called Robin, my ex, and informed her of my upcoming marriage. She wished me well and advised me, "Now you can change your stupid answering machine message." Good idea. She also said, "If you catch this guy, Khalil, someday, throw the case my way." I'd been through this little game with her regarding the perps who plugged me on West 102nd Street, so I said, "Okay, but I want 10% of the fee." You got it. And I'll blow the case, and he goes up for life. It's a deal. So that out of the way, I thought I should call former lady friends and tell them I had a full-time roommate, soon to be my wife. But I didn't want to make those phone calls, so I sent emails, cards, and faxes instead. I actually got a few replies, mostly condolences for the bride-to-be. I didn't share any of these with Kate. The big day approached, and I wasn't nervous. I'd already been married, and I'd faced death many times. I don't mean there are any actual similarities between getting married and getting shot at, but there may be. Kate was pretty cool about the whole thing, though she'd never walked the last mile down the aisle before. She seemed really on top of the situation and knew what had to be done and when it had to be done and who had to do what and all that. I think this knowledge is not learned, but it has something to do with the X chromosome. All kidding aside, I was happy, contented, and more in love than I had ever been. Kate Mayfield was a remarkable woman, and I knew we'd live happily ever after. I think what I liked about her was that she accepted me for what I was, which is actually not too difficult, considering how nearly perfect I am. Also, we'd shared an experience that was as profound and defining as any two people can share, and we'd done it well. Kate Mayfield was brave, loyal, and resourceful, and unlike myself, she was not yet cynical or world-weary. She was, in fact, a patriot, and I can't say the same for myself. I may have been once, but too much has happened to me and to the country in my lifetime. Yet, I do the job. My biggest regret regarding this whole mess, aside from my obvious regret over the loss of life, is that I don't think we learned anything from any of this. Like me, the country has always been lucky and has always managed to dodge the fatal bullet. But luck, as I've learned on the streets and at the gambling tables and in love, runs out. And if it's not too late, you face facts and reality and come up with a plan of survival that does not include any luck. Speaking of which, it rained on our wedding day, which I discovered is supposed to mean good luck. I think it means you get wet. Nearly all of my friends and family had made the trek to this small town in Minnesota, and most of them behaved better than they had at my first wedding. Of course, there were a few incidents with my unmarried NYPD buds being outrageous with these blonde-haired, blue-eyed Wendy's, including the incident of Dom Finelli with a maid of honor, which I will not get into, but that's to be expected. Kate's family were real wasps. The minister was a Methodist and a stand-up comedian. He made me promise to love, honor, and never again mention the X-Files. It was a double ring ceremony. One ring for Kate's finger, one ring through my nose. I guess that's enough marriage jokes. In fact, I've been told that's enough. Midwestern wasps come in two varieties, wet and dry. These people were into the sauce, so we got along really well. Pop was an okay guy. Mom was a looker, and so was Sis. My mother and father told them lots of stories about me, which they thought were funny as opposed to abnormal. This was going to be all right. In any case, Kate and I did a week in Atlantic City, then a week along the California coast. We'd arranged to meet Jean Barlett at Rancho Del Cielo, and the drive up into the mountains was a lot nicer than the last time. So was the ranch, looking better in the sunlight, sans sniper. We went back to the boulder, which looked much smaller than I remembered it. Jean took photos, including an R-rated shot of Kate's wound, and we gathered up some stone chips at Jean's insistence. Jean pointed to the distant tree line and said, "We found 52 shell casings on the ground. I've never heard of so many shots being fired by a sniper at two people. That guy really wanted what he couldn't have." I think he was telling us that the game wasn't over. The tree line was making me a little nervous, so we moved on. Jean showed us where Ted Nash had been found on a riding trail, less than 100 meters from the Vortac, with a single round through his forehead. I have no idea where Ted was going or what he was doing there in the first place, and we'd never know. Considering we were on our honeymoon, I suggested we'd seen enough, and we went back to the ranch house, had a Coke, ate a few jelly beans, and moved on to points north. We had left Kate's cell phone back in New York, not wanting any calls from friends or assassins on our honeymoon. But just as a precaution, we both brought our guns along. You never know.
This has been an Hachette Audio production of The Lion's Game, written by Nelson DeMille, read by Scott Brick. The Lion's Game is also available in print from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2000 by Nelson DeMille. Audio production copyright and published 2000 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental. And now, a clip from The Lion, the sequel to The Lion's Game. Written by Nelson DeMille, read by Scott Brick.
Part 1. New York and New Jersey. Chapter 1. So I'm sitting in a Chevy SUV on 3rd Avenue, waiting for my target. A guy named Khomeini Weenie or something. An Iranian gent who is third deputy something or other with the Iranian mission to the United Nations. Actually, I have all this written down from my report, but this is off the top of my head. Also off the top of my head, I'm John Corey, and I'm an agent with the Federal Anti-Terrorist Task Force. I used to be a homicide detective with the NYPD, but I'm retired on disability. Gunshot wounds, though my wife says I'm also morally disabled. And I've taken this job as a contract agent with the feds, who have more anti-terrorist money than they know how to spend intelligently. The ATTF is mostly an FBI outfit, and I work out at 26 Federal Plaza downtown with my FBI colleagues, which includes my wife. It's not a bad gig, and the work can be interesting, though working for the federal government, the FBI in particular, is a challenge. Speaking of FBI and challenges, my driver today is FBI Special Agent Lisa Sims, right out of Quantico by way of East Wheatfield, Iowa, or someplace, and the tallest building she's previously seen is a grain silo. Also, she does not drive well in Manhattan, but she wants to learn, which is why she's sitting where I should be sitting. Ms. Sims asked me, "How long do we wait for this guy?" "Until he comes out of the building." "What's he going to do?" "We're actually here to find out." "I mean, what do we have on him? Why are we watching him?" "Racial profiling." No response. I added, to be collegial, "He is an Iranian military intelligence officer with diplomatic cover. As you know, we have information that he has asked for his car and driver to be available from 1 p.m. on. That is all we know."
"Right."
Lisa Sims seemed bright enough, and she knew when to stop asking questions. Like now. She's also an attractive young woman in a clean-cut sort of way, and she was dressed casually for this assignment in jeans, running shoes, and a lime-green t-shirt that barely concealed her .40-caliber Glock and pancake holster. I, too, wore running shoes. You never know when you might be sprinting. Jeans, black t-shirt, and a blue sports jacket that concealed my 9mm Glock, my radio, my pocket comb, and breath mints. Beats carrying a purse, like Ms. Sims did. Anyway, it was a nice day in May, and the big ornamental clock across the street said 3:17. We'd been waiting for this character for over 2 hours. The Iranian mission to the UN is located on the upper floors of a 39-story office building off 3rd Avenue. Between East 40th Street and 41st. Because of the UN, Manhattan is home to over 100 foreign missions and consulates, plus residences, and not all of these countries are our buds. So you get a lot of bad actors posing as diplomats who need to be watched, and it's a pain in the ass. They should move the UN to Iowa. But maybe I shouldn't complain. Watching bad guys pays the rent.
I was the team leader today, which is a guarantee of success. And on this surveillance with me were four agents on foot and three other vehicles, another Chevy SUV and two Dodge minivans. The other three vehicles also have one NYPD and one FBI agent, which means at least one person in the vehicle knows what he or she is doing. Sorry, that wasn't nice. Also, FYI, each vehicle is equipped with the whole police package. Flashing lights in the grill, siren, tinted windows, and so forth. Inside the vehicle, we have 35mm digital Nikon cameras with zoom lenses, Sony 8mm video cameras, handheld portable radios, a portable printer, and so on. We all carry a change of clothes, a Kevlar vest, Metro cards, Nextel cell phones with a walkie-talkie feature, sometimes a rifle and scope, and other equipment, depending on the assignment. Like, for instance, a little gadget that detects radioactive substances, which I don't even want to think about. In any case, we are prepared for anything, and have been since 9/11. But you know, shit happens even when you have a shit shield with you. High-tech toys aside, at the end of the day, what you need with you is an alert brain and a gun. When I was a cop, I did a lot of surveillance, so I'm used to this. But Special Agent Sims was getting antsy. She said, maybe we missed him. Not likely. Maybe he changed his plans. They do that. I'll bet they do it on purpose. They do that too. Another 15 minutes passed, and Special Agent Sims used the time to study a street and subway map of Manhattan. She asked me, where do you live? I looked at the map, pointed, and said, here, on East 72nd Street. She glanced out the windshield and said, you're not far from here. Right. You have a map of Iowa? You can show me where you live. She laughed. A few minutes later, she asked me, what is that place behind us? Arbon Payne. It's like a coffee shop, a chain. Do you think I can run out and get a muffin? Well, she had running shoes, but the answer was no, though maybe if Ms. Sims got out of the SUV and if Khomeini Weenie came out of the building and got into a car, then I could drive off and lose Ms. Sims.
John?
Well, my radio crackled and a voice, one of the guys on foot, said, target exiting subject building from courtyard, out and moving. I said to Sims, sure, go ahead.
Didn't he just say?
Hold on. I looked into the courtyard that separated the subject building from the adjacent building where two of my foot guys were helping to keep New York clean by collecting litter. The radio crackled again and Sweeper One said, target heading west to third. I saw our target walking through the courtyard, then passing under the ornamental arch and clock. He was a tall guy, very thin, wearing a well-cut pinstripe suit. We give nicknames or code names to the targets, and this guy had a big beak and moved his head like a bird, so I said into my radio, target is henceforth Big Bird. Big Bird was on the sidewalk now, and all of a sudden another guy, who I profiled as being of Mideastern extraction, came up to Big Bird. I couldn't make this new guy, but Big Bird seemed to know him, and they seemed happy and surprised to see each other, which is pure bullshit. They shook hands, and I thought something was being passed. Or they were just shaking hands, you never know. But they know or suspect that they're being watched, and sometimes they screw with you. Anyway, Big Bird has dip immunity, and we're certainly not going to bust him for shaking hands with another Mideastern gentleman. In fact, now we have two people to watch. Big Bird and the unknown separated, and the unknown began walking north on third, while Big Bird stayed put. This was all captured in photos and video, of course, and maybe someone at 26 Fed knew this other guy. I said into the radio, units 3 and 4 stay with the unknown and try to ID him. They acknowledged, and Ms. Sims said to me, I don't think that was a chance meeting. I did not respond with sarcasm, and I didn't even roll my eyes. I said, I think you're right. This was going to be a long day. A minute later, a big gray Mercedes pulled up near Big Bird, and I could see the dip plates, blue and white, with four numbers followed by DM, which for some unknown reason is the State Department's designation for Iran, then another D, which is diplomat, which I get. The driver, another Iranian gent, jumped out and ran around to the other side of the car like he was being chased by Israeli commandos. He bowed low. I should get my driver to do that. Then opened the door, and Big Bird folded himself into the rear seat. I said into the radio, "Big Bird is mobile." I gave the make and color of the car and the plate number, and Unit 2 acknowledged. Unit 2, by the way, is the blue Dodge minivan driven by a guy I know, Mel Jacobs, NYPD Intelligence Unit detective. Detective Jacobs is Jewish, and he speaks a little Hebrew, which he uses when interrogating Arabic-speaking suspects. That, and the Star of David that he wears, sends these guys into orbit, which is kind of funny to watch. Anyway, the other guy with Mel today is George Foster, an FBI special agent who I've worked with and who I like, because he knows from experience how brilliant I am. The Mercedes headed north on 3rd Avenue, and Special Agent Sims asked me, "Should I follow him?" That might be a good idea. She threw the SUV into gear, and off we went, threading our way through heavy traffic. New York drivers are divided between the good and the dead. It's Darwinian. Ms. Sims would evolve or become extinct. And I'm sitting in the passenger seat to witness one or the other. The Iranian chauffeur, who I think I've followed before, was an erratic driver, and I couldn't tell if he was driving like that to lose a tail, or if he was just a really bad driver. Like, the last thing he drove was a camel. Meanwhile, Special Agent Sims had her chin over the steering wheel between white knuckles, and her right foot was moving from the brakes to the accelerator like she had restless leg syndrome. The Mercedes made a sudden left on 51st Street, and Ms. Sims followed. Unit 2 continued on 3rd, where he'd hang a left on 53rd and run parallel to us until I could tell them what the Mercedes was doing. You don't want a parade following the subject vehicle. You want to mix it up a bit. We were heading west now, and we passed beside St. Patrick's Cathedral, then crossed 5th Avenue. The subject vehicle continued on, which I reported to Unit 2. I had no idea where Big Bird was going, but he was heading toward the theater district in Times Square, where these guys sometimes went to experience American culture, like strip joints and titty bars. I mean, you don't get much of that back in Sandland, right? The Mercedes made the light on 7th Avenue, but we didn't, and we got stuck behind three vehicles. I couldn't see the Mercedes now, but I had seen him continue on 51st. I hit the lights and siren, and the vehicles in front of us squeezed over, and Ms. Sims squeezed past and barreled through the red light, cutting across the southbound traffic on 7th Avenue. We got across the avenue, and I killed the lights and siren, and we continued west on 51st. Ms. Sims glanced at me as though she wanted a compliment or something, so I mumbled, "Good driving." I radioed Unit 2 with our position and said, "I have subject vehicle in sight." We drove through the area called Hell's Kitchen, formerly a nice slum which had gone downhill with an influx of yuppies. I had no idea where Big Bird was going, but if he continued west, maybe he was headed for a Hudson River crossing. I said to Ms. Sims, "He may be going to Jersey." She nodded. In truth, 90% of our surveillances go nowhere. Abdul is just out and about, or he's trying to draw us off from something else that's happening. Or they're just practicing their counter-surveillance techniques. Now and then, though, you get the real thing. Like one of these dips meeting a known bad guy. We do more watching than arresting or interrogating, because these characters can tell us more by keeping them under the eye than they'd tell us in an interrogation room. With the dips, you can't question them anyway. And getting them booted out is left to people with a higher pay grade than mine. Now and then, we do make an arrest, and I'm on the interrogation team, which is a lot more fun than following these clowns. I mean, I'm having fun. They're not. The goal, of course, is to prevent another 9/11 or something worse. So far, so good. But it's been too quiet for too long. Like over a year and a half since that day. So are we lucky or are we good? For sure, the bad guys haven't given up. So we'll see.
The Lion is available as an audiobook from Hachette Audio and in print from Grand Central Publishing, both divisions of Hachette Book Group.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.